Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Bomb theories continue as potential cause of Russian plane crash. President Barack Obama says he thinks there's a possibility a bomb destroyed a Russian jetliner over Egypt last week, killing all 224 passengers and crew.
I don't think we know yet. Whenever you've got a plane crash, first of all, you've got the tragedy. You've got the making sure that there's an investigation on site. I think there is a possibility that there was a bomb on board, and we're taking that very seriously.
In an interview with the Seattle, Washington radio station Thursday, President Obama said U.S. investigators and the intelligence community will be working to find out before any definitive pronouncements. British Prime Minister David Cameron also says it is more likely than not the plane was bombed. Egypt and Russia say it is nothing more than speculation. Islamic State claimed responsibility for attacking the jet. It has yet to offer any evidence to back it up. Tanzania's new president, John Magufuli, was sworn in Thursday despite continuing disputes over the October 25th election. During his swearing-in ceremony in Dar es Salaam, Mr. Magufuli promised to implement the pledges he made during the campaign and appealed to all Tanzanians to unite. The opposition, which boycotted Thursday's ceremony, says a presidential election was rigged and has rejected the results. The outlawed Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, says a ceasefire declared with Turkey ahead of the country's elections is over. The PKK attributed the change in policy to what it called the government's focus on war and its latest attacks. This is VOA News. A number of Islamic State militants were killed and some militant communication links to Syria and Iraq destroyed in a multi-day assault by Afghan and U.S. forces in eastern Afghanistan. The attacks took place in several locations in the Achin district of Nangarhar province. The outgoing U.N. envoy for Libya urged that country's rival leaderships to stop blocking the democratic process and vote on a political agreement that lays out the composition of a future unity government. Bernardino León told the U.N. Security Council in a final briefing Thursday that while there's been progress recently toward resolving outstanding issues, there's still no formal acceptance of any agreement. The head of Russia's Air Force says the military sent anti-aircraft missiles to Syria in order to protect the Russian planes that have been conducting airstrikes there since the end of September. According to Colonel General Viktor Bondarov, the Russian jets were at risk of being attacked or hijacked during their missions. A United Nations watchdog group is accusing Iraq of violating the human rights of its citizens in the name of combating acts of terrorism. Lisa Schlein has more.
The UN Committee of 18 independent experts acknowledged Iraq's need to adopt measures to combat acts of terrorism. This, especially in light of the grave crimes being committed by the so-called Islamic State, including killings, abductions, enslavement, rape, and torture. But it said these horrific acts do not justify the human rights violations reportedly being committed against civilians by Iraqi security forces and allied armed groups in their efforts to defeat IS. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
The United States charged four men with conspiring to travel to Yemen to provide thousands of dollars to the late U.S.-born al-Qaeda leader Anwar al-Awlaki in an effort to support violent jihad against U.S. military personnel in Iraq, Afghanistan, and throughout the world. The four-count indictment was issued Thursday in Ohio. The parliament in the Maldives voted Thursday to impeach Vice President Ahmed Adib, who was arrested last month on suspicion of being involved in an assassination attempt against the country's president. The unanimous vote came just a day after President Abdullah Yameen declared a 30-day state of emergency because of a threat to national security. President Amin's wife and two other people were wounded in a September explosion on a speedboat. The president was not hurt. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration says heroin and prescription drug overdoses have reached epidemic levels in the United States, surpassing car accidents and firearms as a leading cause of injury deaths. The number of drug overdoses climbed more than 50% in just the past decade. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There's high anticipation, Sierra Leone, as the country prepares to be declared Ebola-free tomorrow, Saturday.
Definitely, the entire country is being gripped with excitement because we are approaching the Saturday when we are going to be declared Ebola-free by the WHO after clocking the 42-day cycle.
Abdoulaye Berete is the National Publicity and Outreach Coordinator in the Office of Sierra Leone's Government Spokesman. Pregnant young girls in Sierra Leone will be barred from taking their school exams on November 23rd. And Nigeria's Senate calls for an investigation into former government programs.
It is within the principles, the spirit and the policies of this administration to fight corruption and recover stolen money. So it has nothing to do with witch-hunting anybody.
Senator Shehu Sani is the chairman of Nigeria's Senate Committee on Foreign and Local Debt. South Sudan rebels are denying their leader is due in Juba next week. The Juba government says it does not have the money to implement the current peace agreement. And Egypt faces loss of tourism after Russian plane crash. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Excitement is building in Sierra Leone in anticipation of tomorrow, Saturday, when the country is expected to be declared Ebola-free after going 42 days without any new infections. Abdoulaye Berete, National Publicity and Outreach Coordinator in the Office of Sierra Leone's Government Spokesman, says carnivals are being planned throughout the country to celebrate the day, but also to honor the nearly 4,000 people who lost their lives to the virus.
Definitely, the entire country is being gripped with excitement because we are approaching the Saturday when we are going to be declared Ebola-free by the WHO after clocking the 42-day cycle. But it is one where we are going to reflect, both as a government and as a country, on the losses we made, the many innocent and unsuspecting lives that the Ebola claimed, particularly our frontline health workers, including few of the best of our doctors that passed away in the hands of Ebola. But as the government, we are excited at the same time. The reason being, everywhere you go across the country, a lot of carnivals have been planned. In fact, the civil society female organizations are even planning solar vigil to honor the health workers. And on the Saturday, His Excellency the President will also address the nation.
Still, in the back of your mind, in the back of the minds of Sierra Leoneans, there is still some caution.
Absolutely. In fact, even before the Saturday, the Chief Executive Officer of the National Ebola Response Center has already informed the public that we are still going to maintain the standard operating procedures in terms of dignified medical burial for any suspected case of Ebola, even though we have been declared Ebola-free, and that the practices and measures being put in place of avoiding body contact, of calling the 117, of not taking sick people to the herbalists or the traditional healers, these are still in place. Because don't forget, we don't want any relapse, as it happened, unfortunately, in neighboring Liberia. Are also very mindful about that neighboring Guinea just last week recorded 3 new cases.
You know, Abdoulaye, I do not know how superstitious you are, but I was talking to a Sierra Leone friend of mine, a lady, and we were talking about Saturday. And she mentioned, James, you know, sometimes good can come out of a bad situation. She was referring to the floods that hit Sierra Leone, Freetown particularly, and said maybe the flood water wiped the Ebola into the ocean.
Well, in fact, some people have drawn some symbolism to that, that indeed the flooding that happened, devastating as it was, yet it was like a clean period for Sierra Leone. And a lot of people paid tribute to that. But for us, though, as a country, there is a euphoria of jubilation across all the districts in this country. But within that euphoria, as a government, we have come out very clearly that it must be a cautionary optimism, because we should be mindful that there could be some residues of Ebola, particularly when some of the survivors are still exhibiting symptoms particularly research pointing out that male survivors could continue with the virus in their semen for up to 90 days.
Abdullahi Biriti is the National Publicity and Outreach Coordinator in the Office of Sierra Leone's Government Spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. In Sierra Leone, pregnant young girls will be barred from taking their school exams on November 23rd if the current law remains standing. Amnesty International is calling on the country to not only repeal the ban on pregnant students sitting for exams, but also the nationwide rule that prohibits a pregnant schoolgirl from attending regular classes. The rule was enacted in April this year when schools resumed classes after being closed for months due to the Ebola crisis. Marta Coleman, a West Africa campaigner for Amnesty International, tells Ricky Stryak how the current policy stigmatizes an estimated 10,000 girls.
Amnesty International is really concerned about this ban that is prohibiting pregnant girls to go to school and to take the exams. This is a clear violation of the right of non-discrimination, and physical integrity, and the right to education. These girls are left out of the education system, and this is going to have really important consequences for the future. We feel that these girls are being punished just for the fact of getting pregnant. It's not just about creating an alternative system for pregnant girls, but this is what the government is proposing, but it's giving a choice to the girls, because we feel that this is really discriminatory for these girls that are pregnant, because they are being told, no, you cannot go to normal schools, you have to go to these schools for pregnant girls.
Your report mentions that one way that the teachers and the administrators are finding out if girls are pregnant seems to be through very inappropriate physical tests that you guys documented. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Once the policy was made public, there was any kind of directive for like rules or principles how this is going to be implemented. So what happened then? That every school decided like to take their freedom to decide how to implement this policy. And some girls that were going to school were taught and were forced to have pregnancy tests by people from the school, like teachers or directors. Obviously, when this news started to spread out, there were a lot of girls that were really scared of going to school, you know, thinking that I'm going to be touched, I'm going to have to be humiliated and in front of my colleagues. And many girls decided not to go to take the exams or to restart the lessons. But at the same time, there are other girls that even risk their health, like they strap their bellies and their breath to pretend that they were not pregnant. So they were there, like, really quite scared, thinking what's going on, you know, just coming a teacher and saying, okay, you now come here and let's have, like, a ring test to see who is pregnant and who is not pregnant. This is an attempt, you know, against the physical integrity of these girls and the right to privacy.
It's a couple weeks now before the exams, and not only are the girls being prohibited from going to school, but they're prohibited from taking their exams. Can you tell me, if I'm a young schoolgirl and they don't let me take the exam, how does this hurt my future education?
These visible pregnant girls, how they call it, are not going to be able to take the exam on the 21st of November. And this is very concerning, because if these girls don't take the exam, are going to be left out of the educational system with all the consequences that they have, like for the future.
Marta Coloma is West Africa campaigner for Amnesty International. She was speaking with Ricky Stryak. Nigeria Senate has called on President Muhammadu Buhari's administration to immediately begin investigating former President Goodluck Jonathan's government to recover funds stolen from poverty alleviation programs, including the Subsidy Reinvestment and Empowerment Program. The Senate says the former government must account for funds spent in carrying out the program and other poverty alleviation programs. Senator Shehu Sani, chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign and Local Debt, tells reporter Peter Clotty that there are indications some members of the previous administration used the poverty alleviation programs to enrich themselves.
This has to do with the reports on diversion and corruption that occurred during the last administration of President Goodluck Jonathan. And it is very clear to us in the Senate that if this issue is not properly probed and addressed, it will continue to be an issue for national discourse. So we felt that the best way to do justice to this is to probe the diversion and the corruption that took place, especially with such a program called Sure Fee, so that government will be able to retrieve monies that were stolen and to help in other developmental projects of the present administration.
How soon is the Senate asking the current government to begin the probe, and how thorough will that be?
Well, the current government is concerned about the widespread corruption and the looting that took place under Jonathan. But Jonathan's apologies and party men were raising their voices that the government should not be concerned about what happened in the past. We should move forward. But for now, we're saying that we can still move forward, but we want to know those who stole our money. So the Senate is reconvening on Tuesday. And when it reconvenes, certainly there will be a guideline with regards to how this probe will take place.
There are some supporters of the previous administration that said that President Buhari's administration aims to witch hunt previous administration instead of tackling the numerous challenges the country faces, rather than going about witch hunting them to destroy basically the PDP, you know, in order to perpetuate itself in the next general election. What do you say to such criticisms?
This is not a witch hunt. It is simply about recovering our money that was stolen. And if you look at it, the probe wasn't said that we want to probe Jonathan from the first day and all aspects of his government. But what we are saying is that there are specific aspects of his government and programs of the government that were used as conduit pipe for siphoning public funds. It is within the principles, the spirit and the policies of this administration to fight corruption and recover stolen money. So it has nothing to do with witch hunting anybody.
Senator Shehu Sani is the chairman of Nigeria's Senate Committee on Foreign and Local Debt. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 6th. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brela FM in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. 2 days after signing an agreement on implementing provisions of the current peace agreement, a top South Sudanese official says the government does not have the money to fund the deal. He said the government is calling on the international community, which helped broker the agreement, to help raise the funds. And here, Philip Aton Aliu has more for VOA from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makwe told reporters in Juba today that feeding the vulnerable forces and bombing assembly areas is expensive. Makwe says the peace will be implemented in Juba after the capital is demilitarized. Makwe, who led the government delegation to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia last week to sign a permanent security arrangements deal with the armed opposition and former detainees, says neither the government nor the opposition has enough money to implement certain provisions in the agreement.
We don't have the money. We are very frank. We don't have money in the government of South Sudan. And the rebels have no money. So we agreed that, yes, we should mobilize resources. Because without resources, it will even be difficult for us to start the process as of now.
Makwe says the government needs additional funds for things like feeding and housing the opposition forces, creating assembly areas, clearing roads to military barracks, and providing transportation. He says the government and armed oppositions are appealing to IGAD member countries, as well as the United States, Norway, Great Britain, China, and the European Union, to put up money to fund the peace deal. Makwe says the government will fund the accommodations of SPLMIO officials and former detainees once they return to Juba, but he says it won't be cheap.
We are talking about huge sums that will be spent on the implementation, because the implementation in terms of costing is billions.
SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar has also told South Sudan in Focus in the FAS that neither the government nor its organizations has the money to fund the provisions in the peace deal. Makwe says South Sudan's finance ministry will prepare a detailed budget for implementing the deal during the free transitional and transitional periods. The proposal will be presented to donors at a future venue yet to be worked out. Apart from the funding problem, Makwe says the two parties agreed on security arrangements for Juba, Bor, Malakal, and Bentiu. He says Bor, Malakal, and Bentiu, capitals of the states that have seen the worst fighting, have a special status. Makwe says the government is optimistic that a permanent ceasefire will hold this time around, and that both parties will remain in Juba to implement the agreement. Ban Makwe says other challenges remain, including what appears to be a split among rebel commanders. But he says such challenges will be overcome if the parties cooperate. Meanwhile, Makwe says the head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, former Botswana President Fitus Gotabene Mogae, is due to arrive in Juba today to meet with President Salva Kiir. He says the JMEC office is scheduled to open in Juba in 2 weeks' time. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
A senior official of rebels loyal to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar says Mr. Machar is not due in Juba next week, contrary to reports. Ayet Deng Ajak, former rebel national security minister, had been quoted as saying that Mr. Machar will be accompanied by Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn. But Ezekiel Lo Gatkuof, Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, says the rebels are only sending an advance team to Juba.
This is not true. My chairman is not coming to Juba next week. What he will do, of course, if you can recall, on the 3rd of November, the two parties signed the security arrangement in Juba. And this is now paving the way for Dr. Machar, as the chairman and leader of the SPLM, SPLA in opposition, to send an advance team, of more than 300 people to Juba. And this advance team will leave as early as this month, the middle of the month, maybe 15, 16, 17 of November, to Juba. And they will also go to the 10 states, the capitals of the 10 states. So they will be engaging the government, and they will be engaging the other political parties. They will be engaging the South Sudanese who are in the IDP camps in all the 10 states and in also in Juba. And they will be working very closely with the government to prepare the way for Dr. Machar now to come to Juba officially.
So where did the information come from? Because according to this, it's coming from a reliable source here. I don't know, according to Oyai Deng Ajak, he's a former national security minister and a member of the group of exiled politicians.
I don't know where he got this information from, but what I know, and I can tell you, this is on behalf of the SPLM, SPLA in opposition, the Secretary for Foreign Affairs, that we will be sending a team, an advanced team to Juba. They will be going to 10 states. They will divide themselves into 10 states. Over 300 people will send them. And then now, preparation will be made for Dr. Machar to come to Juba and assume his responsibility as the first vice president of the
Republic. What do you make of the report that came out of Juba on Thursday, quoting the Minister of Information of South Sudan, saying that the South Sudan government does not have the money to implement our provisions of the peace agreement?
Well, we have in the signing ceremony on the 3rd of November 2015, we jointly appealed to the international community that we need support to implement this agreement. We know financially the government is broke. They don't have the money. And that's why it is very important for the international community to come in to help us implement this agreement by providing financial support, technical support, a capacity building support to the people of South Sudan and to the Republic of South Sudan so that we can implement this agreement.
Ambassador Ezekiel Lo Gatkuof is Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. He was speaking with me from Ethiopia. Egyptian officials are trying to rescue their tourism industry after Britain and the United States said the Russian plane crash that killed 224 people appears to be a result of a bomb. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo, analysts say no matter what the cause of the crash, it is going to be a blow to Egypt's ailing economy.
Surrounded by mountains and desert and heavily guarded, Sharm el-Sheikh is usually considered a safe place in Egypt. In the past, hosting international conventions, despite political upheaval in other parts of the country. Russian tourists are the largest single group visiting Sharm el-Sheikh, and Egyptian tour guides often speak Russian. Analysts say reduced tourist traffic after the plane crash is bound to be a blow for the Egyptian economy.
tourism is going to be affected? Of course it's going to be affected, big time. So although there's been talk by some Egyptian tourism officials that a lot of Russian citizens have said that they will not give up the habit of coming to Hurghada and Sharm el Sheikh for vacations, you really need statistics to kind of measure that. But the very simple rationale says that after such an incident, whether it's a technical error or it's an act of terrorism, the kind of how popular Egypt is as a target for tourism is going to be reduced. And this is something that we have to face.
Tourism is one of the most important sectors of the Egyptian economy, being a major source of foreign income and employment. The Egyptian government was planning to launch an international advertising campaign to promote Egyptian tourism just this week. In late September, Egyptian officials had predicted a large increase in tourism in 2016, from roughly $8 billion in income to as much as $10 billion. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile. Goals scored by Kelechi Nwakali, Orji Okwonkwo, Victor Osimhen, and Osinachi Ebere outnumbered those scored by Mexico's Kevin Magana and Diego Cortez, as defending champions Nigeria Golden Eaglets beat Mexico 4-2 in the second semi-final in Viña del Mar on Thursday. Earlier on, Mali recovered from conceding an early goal scored by Dante Rigo, with goals from Boubacar Traore, Sadiki Maiga, and Sekou Keita, as Mali dismissed Belgium 3-1 in the first semi-final in La Serena. Consequently, on Sunday in Viña del Mar, the bronze medal playoff between Belgium and Mexico is a curtain raiser for an all-African showdown in the final, where Mali challenged defending champions Nigeria. In Switzerland, Chad is the most improved national men's team in the world, while Sudan has slipped by the widest margin in the world, according to FIFA rankings released in Zurich on Thursday. African champions Ivory Coast is, for the first time, the continent's highest placed team on the FIFA rankings. The Elephants are 22nd, Algeria's 26th, Ghana 30th, Cape Verde Islands 32nd, Senegal 39th, Tunisia 41st, Cameroon 51st, Republic of Congo 52nd, Guinea 53rd, and the Democratic Republic of Congo 55th. Meanwhile, Ghana host Ethiopia in Kumasi. South Africa welcome Nigeria to Johannesburg in the return leg of the Africa qualifiers for the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup tomorrow Saturday. Elsewhere, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe hosts Algeria's USM Algiers in the return leg of the Orange Africa Champions League final in Lubumbashi on Sunday. TP Mazembe won the first leg 2-1 in Algiers. Finally, hosts Algeria overpowered Libya 118-13 in the men's contest at the African Wheelchair Basketball Championships in Algiers on Thursday. South Africa dismissed Nigeria 67-39 and Morocco edged Egypt 68-62. In the women's event, Nigeria edged South Africa 38-34. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Tanzania's new president, John Magufuli, was sworn in on Thursday despite continuing disputes over the October 25th election. Magufuli and the East African nation's first female vice president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, took the oath of office in front of cheering crowds at Uhuru Stadium in the capital, Dar es Salaam. In a speech, Magufuli promised to work hard to implement the pledges he made during the campaign. That's it for this Friday, November 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Koch, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye, joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, pet peeves. Do you have one? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing Pet Peeves. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.